Hello and welcome to the Stolen Signs podcast with me, Kendall Gilmet, and my co-host, Harry Pavlidis of Baseball Prospectus.
Hi, Kendall.
Hi, Harry. How are you doing?
Good. We're finally doing our podcast.
We are.
This is something that we, you know, it was funny when you first brought it up to me because I long thought about doing a stats podcast and thought it would be too much work. So then you came along looking very willing to do all the work. So I'm glad to be here to talk. I think it's important, though, you know, that we talk, you know, the impetus behind the show, which is to not just learn, as you've said, but also to get to know the people around it and how they got there. So I think what we're going to usually do is have guests on to talk about some stat or topic and talk with them in depth. And tonight we are actually going to have a couple of our friends from Baseball Prospectus join us to talk about something. And they are going to tell us a bit about their background. But tonight it's about us.
All about us.
That's right.
So I'll kick it off here and I'll tell you all about me. So like I said, my name is Kendall Gilmet, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I started following baseball at a pretty young age. My first game was, I think, in 1982. It was a Tigers-Yankees game at Tiger Stadium, and I have very fond memories of Tiger Stadium. But I also moved to Chicago in 1984, which was a good year to move to Chicago.
That was a good year.
But I moved from Michigan, so I was a Tigers fan growing up, and then I moved to Chicago, and so I was a little bit conflicted, but I determined that all of my friends liked the Cubs, and so that seemed like a pretty good thing to do, even though I still had a little piece of my heart that was for the Tigers, and it was a good thing, and that paid off for me. So I got to learn a little bit about the heartbreak of being a Cubs fan, but also got a little bit of the glory with the World Series in 1984. So that fast forward to post-college, I would say, and I really got into baseball through, this is so cliche, but like Moneyball. I read Moneyball and I was like, oh, that's interesting. That's cool. And then shortly after that, my wife got me Baseball Between the Numbers from BP that BP put together a long time ago, and read that cover to cover and was like, this is amazing. Super interesting stuff. I'm a web developer by trade. And so, it kind of got my brain going on kind of using technology and using data to learn and to get to know the sport that I loved already. And that was kind of my gateway drug to start, you know, reading Baseball Prospectus and, you know, listening to various podcasts and just kind of getting sucked into the Baseball Prospectus ecosystem and vortex and all of that. And then fast forward that a couple years, met Harry, started talking with him, and eventually started doing a little bit of work for BP on the development side. And I suggested to Harry, we were working on some projects, and I suggested to Harry that we use Slack. And Slack was an app that I had used, and I thought it was cool, and I thought it would be helpful to kind of keep track of stuff for our work at BP. And Harry was like, sure, let's try that out. And we did. And what happened, from my perspective, was one, there was a cool collaborative tool that we could use on the projects that I was working on, but I also had access to kind of be a fly on the wall for other conversations that were going on. And this was around the time where, you know, some catcher framing stuff was being worked on. Yes. And things like that. And so I was able to just observe the process of thinking about these things. And most of the words that people said didn't make any sense to me. But I was able to follow along just enough to kind of track what people were saying. And that got me thinking about, like, how does this whole thing work, and why do people do it, and why is it important, you know, stats and analysis and thinking about these things kind of from a broader perspective than just like, oh yeah, like baseball has a lot of stats, but like, you know, like there are stories behind it. There are decisions every step along the way, especially for the more advanced stuff. And that's fascinating to me. And so
you inadvertently put yourself in the middle of that place, because I think this was originally for us to work on the web project.
Totally. So yeah.
Marketing stuff.
Yep.
And I don't know what happened.
Yeah, I think
I lost control very quickly. there's a lot of people there, and it is, you are witnessing the birth and death of a lot of ideas.
Yeah, and it's super interesting, and that's been a really cool thing for me. And I think part of why I wanted to start doing this show was to kind of be a proxy for other people to sit in and be flies on the walls of some of this stuff, and to meet people and learn about people who are doing this stuff or who are kind of, you know, neck deep in it. And because it's been fascinating for me. And I think it's really, my hope for this is that we can kind of open it up and make this more accessible, this kind of conversation more accessible to everybody, because I think it's helped me enjoy baseball more. And I think it has the ability to help other people enjoy baseball more. So that's kind of where I'm coming from and what I'm hoping for our show. What about you, Harry?
Yeah, this show for me is a chance to do what you just said, which is basically get more people engaged and understand the process that we're going through. And I'm used to being either an expert or the manager of the experts, and that's kind of puts me in a position of discourse and dialogue that I never thought I won't be a good host for a show like this. And I think what Kendall's description of himself coming from the as the non-statistician, I don't think you use that word. I'll put those words in your mouth, though.
I'm definitely not a statistician.
Yeah. I'm not either. But I think, you know, I abuse numbers. Well, you don't.
not publicly.
So it's having that point of view, I felt was more valuable to an audience than me and my friends and colleagues sitting and talking. Which is basically what would happen without someone like Kendall to help guide us. So we both have a big curiosity about human nature. I think we both find people very interesting based on our conversations that we have.
Yep.
And so I think we're both interested in how these things happen and how these things come together. And I think as we go through the show and how different types of guests we want to bring on, some we're going to know well, some we might not know as well. And I know some of the stories we're going to, I can already think ahead to what some of the stories that you're going to hear as you listen to this podcast will be in the future. And they're going to be really interesting, kind of funny, and kind of strange. I'll kind of give my whole background on how I got into baseball, because it's weird. Like, baseball has gradually, over the course of approximately 40 years, swallowed me whole. And it started out as a child where I was just into sports, like many kids are in this country and other countries. But I was into baseball and hockey, I think, was probably my first love. I think the first athlete I can remember liking was Bobby Clark from the Philadelphia Flyers. So growing up in central New Jersey at that time, I was exposed to Phillies, Mets, and Yankees. and I was in 1970s New Jersey, so the 69 Mets were the greatest thing that ever happened. I now live in Chicago, and I've seen the other side of the 1969 experience, and it's really interesting. So that's given me some perspective. The first major league game I ever saw was in Candlestick Park in 1979. It was actually a doubleheader. Saw J.R. Richard pitch in that game. William McCovey pinch hit there. And in the 1980s, I was a Mets fan, and I you know, watched a lot of baseball on TV on the weekends and even the regular broadcast during the week on WOR, WPIX. So, you know, I got to watch, we lived a little further north in Jersey at that point, got to watch, you know, plenty of baseball and sports growing up. And I took it even further than just watching. I got into Strat-O-Matic. So if people listening don't know what Strat-O-Matic is, just Google it. Basically, it's a card game and dice game that you simulate game play. I started with hockey, went on to baseball. And that's what taught me the probabilistic natures of the game. It taught me that it's without an explicit set of math books and probability books, it taught me all the basic concepts of how baseball plays are actually strung together. How it's a sequence of probabilities that happen in typically very discrete steps. And it, you measure it with outs and runs, and it's not a clock. And it's an incredibly different game. So it's driven by what happens with each event, not how much time is left running out on the clock. You just can't sit there and wait for the clock to run out. You actually have to figure out how to get the 27th out. So in theory, it's possible to lose any lead. You can have an 0-2 count in the ninth inning, and you could be winning by 10 runs, and you could still lose the game. So baseball subverted kind of the typical sports outcome processes and probably became more interesting to me than hockey over that time. But then as I got older, I got less into baseball, and my career took me into similar stuff, what Kendall does today, but many years ago. Doing web development and things like that. And I got into baseball professionally because of PitchFX and because I had some basic web programming skills. I knew how to scrape data. And since I was obsessed with baseball, I could handle sifting through massive amounts of pitch tracking data. And I built up a massive database, asked Dan Brooks to help me with it. He was too lazy to really help me with it, so he just published it. And in the past 10 years, I've gradually become a full-time data provider and manager, and as well as the director of technology here at BP. So I've the final steps of this taking my life over was, you know, I was laid off from work in 2009. My wife was suffering very much from lupus. And in the past 10 years, that's still been the case. But baseball was there for me when I was out of work and needed to be at home. And allowed me to develop a career. So I feel very obliged professionally to pay back because it's given me opportunities to have a life that I don't think I could have had with any other profession. So I think the reasons people get into baseball are varied. The reasons I got into baseball are strange. But I think that we're going to meet a lot of people who have all sorts of different reasons for why they ask questions and how they end up working in baseball. And I hope to show that the non-traditional pathways can be some of the most successful and fruitful ones. And I think some of the analysts you're going to meet that Kendall and I are going to have on are non-traditional. They don't come from some academic math program or an economics degree from Harvard. They may be music majors, they may be lawyers, they may be something altogether different, but they have ideas and passions about baseball, and we're going to get to talk to them about those things and have them teach us about all their fancy ideas.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, I think that that's really exciting that there is such a breadth of experience that has brought us all together about something we care about and spend a lot of time with, and I'm excited to talk about it more with you and with all of our upcoming guests.
And we also want to know from our listeners what they want us to talk about.
Yes.
So we have our own ideas. You know, before we sign off, we want you to make sure that you understand that this is all just an idea. And we think it's going to be interesting to talk about these things. We think it'll be interesting if people exchange their stories and hopefully get into some interesting conversations about each other's backgrounds instead of soliloquies. But we want to know how you learn, what types of baseball topics might be of interest, what type of people, because that way you'll help us from broaden our circles. Because even though between Kendall and I, we have a lot of friends in this business, it's just our circles.
Yep.
And part of this is going to be opening up to other ideas. So yeah. At some point you'll have to pay close attention because Kendall's going to give you some addresses and some ways to reach us.
Yeah. So the way that you can reach out to us is you can hit us up via email at stolen_signs@baseballperspectives.com. And that's also our Twitter handle. So stolen_signs on Twitter. And, via email at Baseball Perspectives. So either one of those things, if you want to just give us any feedback about the show today or say hello on Twitter, feel free. That would be awesome. And like Harry said, we really want to understand what it is, what questions you have or interests that you have that we can talk about and reach out to. Either people we know or introduce us to people we don't know that we should know. So I think that would be really cool. And we'll be back after this. And we're going to talk about, give a little intro to pitch tunneling. And then we'll have on our guests, Jeff Long and Kate Morrison, to talk about that a little bit more in depth and to share their stories with us as well. Stick around. We're back, and today we're going to be talking a little bit later with Kate Morrison and Jeff Long about some pitch tunnels and pitch sequencing stuff. And before we do that, I want to ask Harry a little bit about pitch tunnels and pitch tunnel data that he and Jeff and some other folks have been working on. And Harry, can you give us a high-level overview of what pitch tunnels are, what the data means, all of that kind of stuff. Anything that might be germane to the conversation.
Basically, the concept is one that's just as old as pitching itself. The idea that the batter has to make a decision about the pitch before the ball has arrived to them. So there's this kind of idea that if the batter has less information to distinguish speed and location of the pitch, say halfway to the plate, where they generally have to decide to start a swing or not, that you can do a better job getting them out. It's just, you can't tell if that ball is a fastball or a curveball until it's too late to decide. So this notion of the ball coming out of a tunnel, and at that point, if that tunnel is really wide, because your curveball and your fastball don't stay together, then that's makes it easier in theory for the hitter to identify the pitch. But if your tunnel's really narrow and the ball's coming out pretty much laid out over the same pathway, almost halfway to the plate, that's considered a small tunnel, tight tunnel. That's more deceptive. I think the big concept behind this is that that's a helpful thing, but it's not a mandatory thing, because obviously pitchers like to change their arm slots, and that's totally the opposite of tunneling. So the notion that it's the best way to pitch is a positive to negative scale is a little misleading. So we have all these numbers and what the distance is between the ball at this point, how much break there is after it, how much speed difference there might be. But the most important things of all these quantities is that you can use them to qualitatively understand the pitcher and their approach and what they're doing. So, you know, our guests later will talk a bit about some of the different things pitchers do and why they're doing it. And I think the key thing to remember is that this isn't about good or bad so much, but more about having a very precise, quantitative way of understanding a pitcher's approach and style of how they're doing things. And I think there's one name you'll hear a lot of, not on this broadcast, but in general around pitch tunnels, and it's a guy named Perry Husband. And I think it's important to note that this is not quite what he's talking about. What his concepts were more from the hitter's perspective and about the relative speed of the bat for the ball being placed in different, you know, parts of the strike zone.
And is that, and he talked about effective velocity, is that right?
Yeah, it's the effective velocity.
Okay.
So it's a related concept. It's a very strong related concept. But most of Husband's work is theoretical. I mean, there's a lot of numbers in it, but it's theoretical. There's no actual empirical findings to support it. So we were more interested in doing, you know, we were definitely influenced by it. We read his book and we read, you know, literally dozens of things about this subject. But the thing is, we want it to be quantified so then people can start doing research. And what Jeff and Kate are going to tell us about in a few minutes here is about an extension of these basic concepts, and not just on a research track, but also in terms of producing additional data for other people to produce research as well.
Got it. So let me back you up just a little bit. So the pitch tunneling data measures halfway
yeah,
to home plate.
Halfway, 25 feet from the plate.
And and then from there, it's location and break.
Those are kind of the two. Thing is, what's the location? Well, really, we start at release point. You know, how far apart is the release, which is, you know, relative distance. It's going to be a bigger difference there. It's going to be, you know, more important than a small difference closer up.
Right.
Or excuse me, you know what I mean. So we start with that. How far is that? What's the gap at release? Then we say, what's their gap at the tunnel point? And we just chose a fixed point in space, a distance, which is probably not perfect, but for the first rendition of this data set, we thought that would be the most reasonable way to handle the problem for various reasons. So you take that point. So when the balls travel to that point, you know, 25 or so feet from home plate, we then measure, okay, how far apart are the ball, the pitch one and pitch two, when they cross that point. And then from there on, we measure how much they break, which is, you know, just to get a difference of, you know, how close together are they, and then how much did they diverge beyond what their, you know, trajectory may have been, which, so if they're matched at release and they're matched at tunnel, really the only thing left is spin to move them to break. So that's an important thing. Then we also just point out where they actually crossed home plate, which is helpful. And then there's ratios between these things as well. So what's the ratio of your break after the pitch, how much is the pitch breaking relative to the distance between the two pitches at the tunnel point, things like that.
Okay.
And then there's the difference in flight time, which is just the difference in speed. So you can see how guys change speed. So there's lots of different separate data points. And basically for every pitcher, we know that we take all their fastballs that were followed by another fastball, and that's one row of data, and so forth and so on.
Okay. Cool. Well, thanks for giving us a little primer there so we can understand what Jeff and Kate are going to be talking about here in a little bit. And we'll be back in a few minutes and hear what they have to say about their upcoming presentation at Sabre Seminar about pitch tunneling and sequencing. Joining us today, we have Jeff Long and Kate Morrison, who who are going to be presenting at Saber Seminar 2017, and they're here to talk a little bit about what they're going to be presenting and also just talk to us in general about pitch tunnels and pitch sequencing and what they're all about. So thanks for joining us, Jeff and Kate.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us. Yeah.
So if you guys could give us a brief overview of kind of what you're going to be talking about at Saber Seminar and what you want to share with our listeners here. And just kind of take it from there.
No, sure. Yeah. I guess I'll start. We kind of originally, we really wanted to build on the initial concept of pitch tunnels. And we released that data in January. And I think it was one of those things where it was sort of like, oh, wow, this is really interesting. And we have a lot of new data points that we can look at. But we weren't really sure how to use it. And when I say we, I mean kind of everybody involved in the project. I mean, we had an idea that it was pretty important, but we didn't necessarily know what exactly it meant or how it should be used to better understand pitchers and those sorts of things. And so over time, we've tried to poke and prod at it and figure out what's really meaningful in here. And I think one of the things that became evident fairly quickly was this idea that the pitch that you throw, this is going to sound really silly, but the pitch that you throw before the one you're about to throw is really important. And this is sort of, Harry and I have talked a lot about the fact that we're really sort of just quantifying things that baseball players already know. And so really this is sort of the concept of setting up hitters that the, you know, you throw a particular pitch so that you can follow it up with the pitch that you really want to throw. But we had an inkling that this was really important. And we saw through some of the pitch tunnels data that, you know, there was something to that idea, something to that concept. And it naturally led itself to a deeper conversation about pitch sequencing and how pitchers link pitches together and what sort of combinations do they like to go to. And Kate had previously presented about pitch sequencing at Saber Seminar. And so we felt like it was a natural fit to start bringing those two worlds together. And so it sort of starts with pitch tunnels and this concept of how two pitches are similar or different and what the hitter is adjusting to when he's looking at those two pitches. But then it gets into the choices that the hitter is making as they go. And I'll let Kate kind of expand on how we tied in pitch sequencing, but that was sort of the impetus behind what we started to look at from a research standpoint.
Well, my 2 years ago, my abstract on was looking at pitching in a different way rather than looking at it strictly as pitch to pitch. So, you know, fastball, changeup, slider, they're throwing this, they're throwing that. And it can be really easy to look and say, oh, well, this guy always gets beaten on his slider or something like that. And I was really interested in the decisions that go behind, that go on between pitches, that go on and go into deciding what pitch to throw next. And so my presentation was really kind of a broad overview at what if we looked at pitching as more combinations of strings, which fits right into this theory on pitch tunneling and pitch selection. So what we're really looking at is the difference between two pitches and what that does to the outcome of the second pitch. So when you look at an at bat, when you look at an at bat, it's, you know, that's a finite kind of moment in time between a pitcher and a batter. And, you know, obviously I believe it's pitcher, batter, and catcher. It's a three-person relationship there, but it's a, you know, each, so say it's like an Ian Kinsler 9-pitch at bat or something like that. In those 9 pitches, you have all of these different relationships between pitch to pitch. And that's what we're really looking at is, you know, are those relationships significant? Because, you know, logically you think, oh, well, of course they are. I mean, that's why we look at bats. That's why we look at these pitchers. That's why we talk about, you know, good break on a curveball or something like that. But obviously, I mean, we've had things that were intuitive or that seemed intuitive in baseball be kind of counterproven by deeper dives using analytics. And so it's always good to get into the numbers and get into what's going on kind of a, you know, microscopic level and say, how are these things connected within results?
So that's kind of the new addition to the work that you guys are bringing up into this talk, isn't it? I mean, because what we published to date is just the relationship between the two pitches in terms of space, where they were in break. But what you guys have layered in now are what the outcomes are and how those relate to pitch pairs of different characteristics, right?
I mean, on a kind of a high level, that it's adding in a third dimension.
Well, and I think too, you know, we went into this conversation and tried to sort of figure out what's interesting is when you look at things from like an analytical standpoint and you start to try and quantify, you know, phenomenon that we see that occur in the game, right? Back-to-back pitches. And we start to literally quantify what is the distance between those two pitches. How close are they? How far are they apart? What have you? It's really easy to sort of get away from the context of what these pitches are doing in relation to one another or what they're doing in relation to the goal of the pitcher in that particular at bat. And this is a really good way for us to layer that context back on. I think it's really important to look at things from that sort of context agnostic point of view to get a better picture of what's going on. But then the application of the data really comes when you're able to layer that context back in and put it into a context of what is the outcome of that pitch? What is the result? Because ultimately that's what pitchers care about, right? They care about better results. And so it's not
the result of a pitch so much as result of two pitches. Really the research question that you know, I think that's been lacking for many years, that we've always had metrics around, you know, the linear weight value of a single pitch. So you can say this guy's fastball is worth so and so many runs plus or minus over the course of a year. But the critique of that was always, this doesn't take into account how that was set up and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And going four or five pitches deep and understanding how that impacts it, hitters pretty far. But I think this is a pretty large leap just going from one to two.
Well, what we're really saying is, what if it's not the fastball's fault, but the changeup before the fastball?
Right. Exactly. Right.
And that's, you know, something that hasn't really been addressed publicly for the most part. It's something that, you know, if you talk about it in kind of a different way in like player development circles or in evaluation circles, mm-hmm. people will talk about sequencing, and we'll talk about, and this is one thing you hear about with both catchers and with pitchers. You know, you watch this like 20-year-old, and if the scout next to you says, oh, that kid really knows how to pitch, that's what this is we're quantifying part of that kind of nebulous, that kid really knows how to pitch thing. Because it's in the understanding.
Yeah, and I think at the major league level, you see it with, you know, guys throwing a fastball over the plate in a two-strike count and freezing the hitter. That is all based on what the prior pitch was or prior two pitches were, or maybe something you did, you know, in spring training if you're Greg Maddux and you're at the, you know, guru level of setting guys up. But for analytical purposes, we're not going to be trying to link 6 months of data. It's what was the pitch before. But I think that, you know, I think Kate, you said that it's not the fastball's fault, it was a changeup before. And I think that's exactly right. It may not be, another way to look at that is, it may not be the changeup before, but the fastball wasn't, it was a good fastball, it was a good changeup, but that's not the pitch to throw him after, because you just, you know, you just sped up his bat or slowed down his bat, or you just change his eye level. Don't you know, take advantage of that. So it could be two good pitches.
Well, and what you just, you know, said, their changes spot, eye level.
But they weren't, you know, mm-hmm. put together well. And that's what this will help, I think.
Well, and what you just said about changing the eye level is something that actually we'll be talking about briefly, but we'll be talking about it in our presentation about, you know, we're sitting here talking about tunnels and tunneling and but we're also going to talk about when you can like get away with not tunneling, because it's not necessarily, you know, it's the way I view it, at least it's a theory of pitching. It's not the theory of pitching.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think too, this is one of those things where you sort of have this revelation that's so obvious and you wonder, why didn't I have that revelation?
I mean, I literally asked Jeff, I was like, wait, are we certain that this hasn't been like said already? just like in a different way.
Yeah. I mean, so like the one of the things that really clicked for me, I was talking to a pitching coach and I said it, and it was just one of those things that just like kind of came out of my mouth without really processing it. And then I was like, wait, that was like kind of profound. But all I said was, the slider is effective because it looks like a fastball. And that kind of like, duh, you know, like that's the dumbest thing to have a, you know, epiphany about. But that is fundamentally what makes a slider so difficult to hit, is because hitters go to the plate with a plan. For a lot of hitters, that plan is, I'm looking for a fastball. And the effectiveness of a slider comes almost exclusively from the fact that it fools a hitter into thinking it's a fastball when it's not. And that is sort of that two pitch interplay that is really important here, because, you know, you don't necessarily have to throw fastball slider for it to be effective. In fact, we can see in data that you might get better outcomes from throwing a changeup slider, because you also throw a lot of changeup fastballs. And so a batter sees a changeup and they're expecting a fastball. But if you throw a slider there because it looks like a fastball but isn't one, it fools the hitter, right? And so you get into all these sort of hypothetical opportunities to try and to test out, simply based on the fact that you're able to preempt the thought process of the hitter and sort of think one step ahead of them by thinking about how your pitches are getting paired together. And so that's sort of that bleeding obvious thing that's like, God, how did I not think of that before, you know?
Right. And so as you guys have done this research, and I know you're going to be presenting it, so don't want to like spoil any of the results, but like what's the context of what you found, like as you're looking at your data, like, and you're going to be presenting it and talking about it, like, is this something that where we're going to be able to look at some sort of chart or a table, or is it going to be just a bunch of data points? Like how are we going to be able to kind of ingest this as the public and try and understand it in a way that makes sense, and that we can also then start thinking about it and looking at it as we see new data come out, so we can just understand it better?
Well, we're presenting some stuff in some charts just to make it more visually appealing. I'm a firm believer in visual aids. I'm not certain. Jeff, you would know more about any future like research-based plans or something for our website or something.
Yeah, I mean, I think visualizing the pitches is going to be a big next step for us, and it's something we're working on. The hard part is, it's very hard to depict the pitches in 3D flight in a way that does justice to what a hitter sees or to what a hitter experiences. And we want to make sure that from a visualization standpoint that we do justice to that. But I think that will be immensely helpful, because it is, you know, right now the pitch tunnels data is just data points. And we can show some really interesting things, and we can point out some, and we'll actually, one of the things that we do in our presentation before we get into the deep dive in sequencing is show how pitch tunnels data can help us see pitcher evolution over time. So we're looking at a particular pitcher and showing very specific things that have changed about their approach from year to year to year, and some, you know, loose connections, correlations, I would say, not necessarily causation, but correlations to performance changes based on changes that have happened through their pitch tunnel data, kind of looking at it through that lens. So that's another way that we can do it, is we can take a look at a particular pitcher and use them as an example to show change over time. And we can, you know, show charts that show change in release point or charts that show changes in tunnel distance and things like that. But I really believe that being able to visualize the pitches in 3D space will be a game changer. It's just, it's a very challenging problem to solve. And it's one that we want to make sure that we do a really good job of. So that's an ongoing project that hopefully we'll have something to, you know, show in the relative future, but it took us a couple of years to actually pull the data together. So
promises. I mean, basically there's, if we know what we need to do and we think we know how to do it, but I'm not, you know, I don't, those two things don't always add up to it looks good and is useful. Because, you know, right now it's this just tables of numbers. And that's not bad. I mean, that's a lot of information. So that's probably a good way for some people, but it's not accessible enough and compelling enough for all the audiences. But I think first is what you guys are doing now is going to be, will probably give us the ideas and the direction that we need to figure out together.
Yeah, that's great stuff. Thank you guys. And we're looking forward to your presentation at Saber Seminar and what comes out of the continuing research into pitch tunnels. So with that, we're going to move into talking a little bit about how you two got involved in baseball analysis. Kate, do you want to give a little introduction of kind of how you got into this this mess in the first place?
I've been a baseball fan my entire life. My mom made sure of that. But I really started getting into it during my, I would say, sophomore, junior year of college. I got really interested in kind of the futures of some of the, specifically the Rangers minor leaguers. And then that turned into wanting to do, you know, minor league evaluation, and that turned into bugging literally everybody I knew for, you know, any information they could give me on, you know, pitch identification and pitch tracking and how to watch swings and how to watch this and that. And it just kind of snowballed from there. Sometimes I'm still not entirely certain how the dots are connected from me in college saying, yeah, I'll write about Rangers prospects to my editor at WFAA. To now, it's been kind of a wild ride.
But you weren't studying journalism or baseball or pitch tracking in college, were you?
No, I have a degree in music. In fact, I have a bachelor's of music in applied flute. I have one of the most useless degrees you can have. It's great. But, you know, it still brought me things that are really useful. Like, you know, you would not believe the amount of actual research that goes into having a performance degree. And so having that research background and having that kind of really good grounding from my professors has helped me with what I do now and how I approach things now. So it wasn't all sitting in a practice room staring at the wall.
Fluting.
Well, you see, that was part of the reason was that I, until I got to college, I like never had to practice because I was just better than everybody else just because. And then when I got to college, I actually had to practice. And so that was a new experience.
So that's similar to how baseball, baseball players come out of high school, they're all the superstar and they go to that next level, whether it's collegiate or pro ball. It's the same parallel, really. So,
well, there are a lot of, I've actually found that because, you know, one could argue that both baseball and the performing arts are, they're both performances. You know, a baseball player is getting out there in front of a crowd and having to perform their best in front of that crowd, as, you know, the same thing for a music major or, you know, any musician. And so it's actually something that I'm very interested in is the parallels between the mental approaches to high performance sports and high performance arts. So even, you know, your theater majors and stuff like that, because I've actually, and this is something that I'm probably going to try to get into more next year, and as especially something like the parallel between the yips and you know, something like musicians can actually get the yips. It's, you know, something where your fingers just won't work, your face just won't work, or something like that. So I think there's actually are a lot of parallels, and that's actually kind of informed the way that I do evaluation, is my experience with being in a high stress environment where you have to perform.
See, now you can never say that your degree is useless to you. So, Jeff, what type of academic background are you wasting in baseball?
So I actually started writing about baseball when I was in grad school. And this is going to sound terrible, but I was sitting in classes, and I was a business major in undergrad, and I got my master's in business. And, you know, there were classes, especially I was a marketing major. So there were especially like marketing classes where I had a whole degree in this thing. And, we were teaching marketing to people who had accounting degrees and people who had finance degrees. And so I kind of was just bored because we were going over stuff that I had taken multiple classes in. And I started writing about the Orioles on my own website, and it just kind of ballooned from there. I got asked to write for a larger website that covered all of Baltimore sports. And then I joined Beyond the Box Score and did that for a while before Sam Miller asked me to join Baseball Prospectus, which was actually a really funny moment, because I remember it super vividly. I was sitting in a meeting at work, and I got a Twitter direct message. Sam slid into my DMs actually. And, I was why is Sam Miller direct messaging me? Like, what is happening? I was scared. It was very confusing because I just had no concept that I could ever be asked to join Baseball Prospectus. And wrote a weekly column for, I guess, about a year and a half or so. And then kind of decided that I would rather focus on bigger long-term projects like Pitch Tunnels. And, you know, from there, Harry eventually kind of caved and invited me to join the stats team. And
I am cajolable. This is true.
I think I just more annoyed you into submission, actually.
that's funny, because I, as I remember it, for me, Harry just kind of was like, here, do this thing, download Slack. And yeah, that was a... Yeah. Life-changing experience.
Kendall's the person who introduced me to Slack, so you can blame Kendall for all of this.
That's right. Blame me. I'll take it.
It's all Kendall's fault.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah, I mean, now I do a little bit of scouting. I'm sort of learning that world and learning the ropes there. I'm still doing some stat stuff. I get to do some really kind of fun and interesting projects, and we're trying to expand and build on the Pitch Tunnel piece and what are the applications there, which has been really cool and exciting. And, you know, for me, it's really, I'm just passionate about baseball. I played it a lot when I was younger, ended up getting hurt, and, I couldn't really... I knew it wasn't a baseball career, wasn't ahead of me. And so after taking some time off from playing, I sort of came back into it from the analysis side of things and thought, hey, you know, this is a really interesting and fun way to look at the game. And really it just grew from there in terms of what I wanted to learn. And I'm the type of person who likes to always be learning and always asking questions and always digging into why things are the way they are and how do they work and that sort of thing. And so it's all sort of spawned out of that, of just trying to develop a better understanding of how the game works and why things happen the way they do. And I poke and prod at people much smarter than me, like Alan Nathan and Harry and Dan Brooks and, you know, any number of people, to try and understand half of the things that they know inside and out and backwards, just so that I can try and develop a deeper understanding and approach things from a slightly different angle. And, you know, so it's basically my entire approach to the game is just approaching things from a slightly askew angle from the way that pretty much everyone else looks at things, which is sometimes delivered really poor, not useful results, but also sometimes has delivered some really interesting ideas and concepts. So
Well, the good advice is keep the good stuff. So
yeah,
that applies to music, to sport, to anything where it's a creative endeavor. And yes, sport is creative. Yes, analysis is creative. So it's not surprising that people who like to solve problems, who like to learn new things, are intrigued by baseball analysis, because it's one of the things I think we're going to learn over the course of this series that we're hoping to produce here, is that there's people come from many different backgrounds, but they share some common themes. So we hope to be able to get into that more deeply with you guys in the future. But for now, we must say thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today, Kate and Jeff. And so we can find your work at Baseball Prospectus. Anywhere else that you want to plug or get out there?
You can find me also at FanRag Sports, where I write about general MLB kind of stuff. And then I'm like a very, very occasional contributor to the local WFA, which is an ABC affiliate down here for Rangers stuff.
Okay, great.
I pretty much just write for BP. I don't have the patience to like deal with other people, and frankly, I think BP, the editors are kind of like, who's this annoying guy? That, yeah.
I mean, you just gotta be strong willed, and you gotta, you know your editors.
It's good advice.
All right, guys. Well, again, thanks so much for hopping on, and we look forward to your presentation, and then also talking about tunneling and pitch sequencing with you guys again soon.
Oh, and we are planning on putting our presentation up on SlideShare after the conference, so even if you can't make it, you should be able to see it.
Oh, perfect.
That's great. And good luck in completing your project.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you guys for having us.
All right.
Thanks for being our first guest.
Thanks, guys.
No, thank you.
No, jerk. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's too much gratitude.
Thank you, Harry. Thank you.
Thank you all so much. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to drop off before y'all keep doing that. I will talk to y'all later.
Bye, Jeff.
Bye, guys. You walk away, you walk away. Walk away, you walk away. From color codes and Whitley Bay. I do walk away. And girl, it looks so pretty to me. Like it always did. Like the Spanish city to me. When we were kids, girl, it looked so pretty to me. All right, everybody, that is all for today. We are wrapping up here our first episode of the Stolen Signs podcast from Baseball Prospectus. Thank you for joining us, and we thank our guests Jeff Long and Kate Morrison from BP. And again, we want to hear from you. So if you email us at stolen_signs@baseballprospectus.com or reach us on Twitter at @stolen_signs and introduce yourselves and say hello, and we would love to meet you guys. Harry, thanks for doing this. This is exciting. I'm really excited to see where we go and to meet people and hear their stories.
Me too. Thank you, Kendall. And we look forward to hearing from our listeners. And please definitely take to heart the idea that we want your ideas for guests and subjects for the show, because, you know, like Kendall just said, it's about kind of finding things, finding people, finding ideas. So we could definitely use your help in rounding that out. And we look forward to talking to you next time.